The song is called Back on the Map. It's Kacey Musgraves, who she's carved out her own spot on the map. Musically has her own niche. No one else quite like her in popular music these days. If you don't know her, you should check it out. Several weeks ago, I was given a sneak preview of Missing 411, the movie. It's a documentary film being produced to tell the stories that we've been talking about tonight and others, the stories of people who've lost loved ones, folks who have vanished, and the story, the investigation that Dave Politis started some years ago. The film is now edited, I'm told. It's being entered in some prestigious festivals. The man who directed it is Ben Politis, David's son, and he's going to join me in just a minute to talk about the film, where it is, and how folks can see it. And then we'll take your calls and questions about the subject matter as well. Stick around for our final hour of Coast to Coast. Missing 411, the movie, has been edited, produced. It's ready to be seen at a couple of festivals. Its director is Ben Politis. Welcome him to the program for the first time. Ben, good to have you here.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on. It's really great to finally be on the show.
So give us a sort of the status report. A lot of the folks who are listening tonight probably helped with the crowdsource funding of the project. Where did things stand? How do you like it?
Yeah, so the film is completed. We've shown it to a select few people, you being one of them. And so far, the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. I think I actually co-directed it with Michael DeGrazier, who you met when we all met in Las Vegas. And he also co-edited it. And between him and I think we have something like 100,000 hours invested just in this film. So it's been a super long journey. We're thrilled that we're nearing the finish line and we can get this out to everybody, because it's something that we're so proud of. I mean, that to carry on the work that my dad has done and get that kind of opportunity, I mean, we're really excited to get it out there.
So spill some family secrets. Did you want to work on this? Did you ask your father, hey, can I get in on it? Or did he ask you?
No, yeah, I actually had to sell him on my ability, because I came straight out of undergrad. And, you know, I knew I wanted to do film. And he was, you know, he had been approached by several other groups of people who were going to take the material and kind of do something with it that wasn't maybe ethical or moral. And we both knew that it needed to be a film that told the truth, that stayed true to the families, that stayed true to the facts, especially. And so when I proposed this plan for the film and told him that I would bring in Michael, who had a ton of experience, to be co-director, I would produce, he was pretty impressed. And luckily, we raised all the money on Kickstarter and made a really great Kickstarter video, and the support's been just absolutely overwhelming.
Give me your take on it from inside the family, as your dad has gone down this very strange path. When you first start reading these books, what are you thinking? Has dad gone around the bend, or is this really interesting? Were you hooked right off the bat, or what?
No, I mean, I've always been super intrigued by his work. I don't think I fully appreciated it until I was a bit older and I had some kind of life experience for myself, because, you know, I think there's an old saying that, you know, one murder is a tragedy, but 6 million's a statistic, you know. And we try to, in the documentary, give a human face to the work, because, I mean, you can read and you can kind of get lost in the statistics, but it was really important. And, you know, my dad was a huge supporter of this the whole time. You know, let's tell a human story. So that's what always attracted me to the material, was the emotional core, and just like these families are living without any closure whatsoever. And, you know, people debate, what happened to them, but the fact of the matter is they're gone and there's no explanation. So
it's, yeah, I had the same reaction seeing that. You know, I've done a lot of interviews with your father and we've covered all of his books on this program, and it almost is mind-numbing to some degree. You read case after case. Occasionally there's a photograph that accompanies a case file or a report that puts a face on it, but nothing like the power of video and film to tell a story and to personalize it. And that's what moved me, is that these are real people who have experienced an incredible loss and have faced an indescribable mystery that that they can't figure out. That's what I liked about it.
Well, thanks, George. Yeah, I mean, that was our aim. And there's one case in particular where this family, Dior Kuntz, went missing in Lodore, just outside Lodore, Idaho, last year in July, so this time in 2015. And for the longest time, his parents were vilified in the media. And when we went up there and met with the family and heard about the story of little Dior going missing, which we talked about in the film, it was kind of disheartening to see this family kind of shy away from wanting to talk about their son in the media, because every time they went out, it was just an onslaught of out-and-out lies by, you know, a lot of these Facebook paparazzi people. And so, in a sense, the documentary almost plays a dual purpose, because it shows, you know, how quickly people use misinformation to target some of these family members, which is insane, and then also the strange disappearances of these children. So you have kind of the social context and then the, what I like to say, subcultural context.
Yeah, when you have a child that disappears, it's the family that's the main suspect, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you hear every time. And there's, in a lot of cases, that's what, you know, these professionals are trained to look for. And in many cases, it turns out, unfortunately, to be true that it is a family member. But in so many of these other cases where the child is found vast distances away, the parent wasn't even there at the time and is accounted for. I mean, there's just, and you see this time and time again. So it's, I mean, the wilderness always has had this mystique to me. And to actually go out there and be in a spot where this person was last seen, and you're standing there and the wind stops blowing, it is very surreal. And we tried to capture that so the audience can kind of understand how we felt as filmmakers.
What kind of level of cooperation did you get from government folks, Park Service, Department of Interior? I know, you know, we've talked about the sensitivities there, and there was some resistance to cough up information. What about for the film?
Right. So we did get an interview with the top administrative official who was actually appointed by Obama. And we urge you to check out the movie when it comes out, because what he says is kind of boggling. And I mean, you saw, so we were able to kind of maneuver our way to get an interview. We said it was about national parks, and the documentary has a large section about national parks, and that is what we kind of said. So but then, you know, he wasn't in the National Park Service, so we had to try to pursue the Park Service, and that's, you know, it's a big part of this film, because we had people going on talking about how they'd like to see more search and rescue. They'd like to see the Park Service pull in outside operations earlier. You have search and rescue officials who talk about finding children with their clothes off. You know, it's kind of a very, it's, somebody described it as a documentary horror movie, because it's almost uncomprehendable to think what could be happening.
Well, we're going to come back to that. The person you're talking about interviewing was the Secretary of the Interior. And yeah, he was given that job by Obama. It was kind of a contentious interview that we'll let people see for themselves. What about other levels of cooperation lower down the food chain? Rangers, folks who had worked at these agencies, you had some people who at least were willing to appear on camera.
Right. And what I always kind of tell people is, the documentary isn't written until it's edited. And a documentary needs to tell a story. And the story was definitely about these kids. And when we approached law enforcement officials, you know, private investigators, they were very willing to get on there and kind of talk about finding these children, because that's foremost the important thing in everybody's mind and what everybody wants to see. So we did get a chance to interview a few park rangers. Most of them went off camera, but And you look at maybe 10 cases initially when you're filming, and it boils down to four at the end because you don't get enough leads. And because that's what we're trying to, be out there doing, is kind of reporting on this stuff. And I think the Dior Kunz case, when we had the sheriff and the private investigator of the case, as well as all the suspects and persons of interest in the entire case, we got like full access to all of them. So I think people are going to, it's going to be pretty enlightening.
What's heartbreaking is the parents of kids who disappear, who blame themselves. You can see it as they're struggling to even tell the story. They're not only chastised and suspected by their neighbors and friends, but they're racked by guilt. If I had only done something different, it must be my fault. They blame themselves, don't they?
Yeah, and I really don't think anybody can pass judgment on people like that until it has happened to them. And unfortunately, when you have with the rise of social media, you get so many great things. I mean, interconnectedness, you can start a revolution now politically. Like, it's great things, but at the same time, it can really tear down people and other good causes. So, we saw in the Dior Kunz case, these parents, people were quick to judge. And that's how we got the interview with them, is we wanted to say, we said, hey, we want to tell the story, and we want to show people who you really are and what really happened to your son and all the facts involved. And I think it's going to, Little Dior was featured on the cover of People magazine 3 weeks ago. And this is something that the public, I think, feels very strongly about. And we wanted to definitely tell it in the right context, in the right manner. So in order to kind of exonerate them, in a sense, in the public's viewing.
You had a little bit of star power in there, a face that a lot of our viewers would know. Tell me who that was and what contributions he made.
Yeah, so I know my dad and Les Stroud has collaborated a bit in the past on a few different projects, given their areas of expertise. Les Stroud, Survivor Man, longest running cable television show from Discovery Channel, talks extensively in the documentary about one of our missing cases and how unlikely / impossible it would be for one of these children to go the distance they do. And I think when you see the terrain and you see, Survivor Man up there, like, you're like, well, I don't know what else I need to be convinced of, because he's, he's always been legit. He's filmed all his own stuff. He's kind of like an all fact, no BS kind of guy. And he was super helpful and he continues to want to help. So we were very lucky and happy to have him be involved.
Does he have a theory? And the same question to you. Your father is notorious for going nowhere near giving an answer or saying what he suspects is going on. Do you, even if you can't answer, do you have a theory in mind that explains it?
Well, you know what? I think my dad doesn't want to give a theory because there is no suitable theory that can be given. I mean, right now there is not enough evidence to really understand what is going on. And until that happens, I think it'd be foolish to really jump to a conclusion. There's things that we don't fully understand about the world we live in. I mean, there's so many things we don't even know that we don't know. So why would we ever kind of jump to that and then say, well, this is absolutely happening to these children?
Well, I agree with that. I mean, you don't know the answer to who or why. You do know some of the what's going on. It's like a harvest. It's like a reaping or a predatory behavior on the part of something. Is that going too far?
Well, it's tough to say predatorial, and the only reason I say that is because in very
hello. We're going to hold on a second here for Ben. We've got a lot of callers on the line, and maybe we'll try. There's a caller from Melbourne, Australia. I was going to open up the phone lines. in a moment. What we are going to get into in a second was about the film itself. It's been entered in a couple of festivals. I think one is Telluride. They won't know for a little bit whether or not it's accepted. What I don't know the answer to is whether when the public will be able to see the film and what venue they will use to distribute it. So when we get Ben back on the phone, maybe he can tell us. In the meantime, we'll just go to the phones and start taking some calls from our listeners. There's Paul in Melbourne, Australia. Hi, Paul. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
Hi, how you doing? What's on your mind?
You listening?
You David's called us. Would you like to talk about this?
Yeah. David's gone off the air, hasn't he?
David has been off the air. This is Ben is his son. We're trying to get him back on. But if you want to just kind of lead into what you wanted to talk about, we'll be have him back in a second. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Are you guys familiar? You're not familiar with Black Mountain in Queensland, are you?
I'm not, but why don't you share it with us? Hello?
Yep. Are you guys familiar with the TV show The Extraordinary? Or
I am not. Did you have a story you want to share with us about something that happened down there?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. You can call back, and we'll talk about it another time. Ben, if you're back, can you tell us about the festivals that you've entered the film in and where things stand and then when the general public can start to see it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've only entered into a few festivals right now, a few of the top ones. I don't want to say which ones at this point because I don't want to over-publicize the kind of the thing until we know exactly which one we get into. But we're hoping to have this film out sometime in probably Q4 of this year or Q1 of next year. And that's just dependent on what festivals we get into. But the independent film route, in order to kind of rise the ranks, takes a longer process than we had originally anticipated. But we're gonna get it out there as quickly as we can because we think it's important.
What's the platform for the public to see it, though? In theaters or on video or on demand or what?
We're probably gonna aim for a streaming service or a network. There's a lot of documentary kind of distributors out there, and we're just trying to figure out the right one who's gonna, you know, let us show what we edited and then put it out there for public consumption. So that's kind of TBD at this point.
And I know that the crowdfunding was the way you raised the money for it. Did you have enough? I guess it's never enough.
Right. I mean, in filmmaking, you always plan for the worst and hope for the best. But I mean, we had a lot of money, and so many of the people that worked on the project took reduced rates or didn't get paid at all, just to see this thing get through. And the people I've shown it for to say that it looks more like a $1 million documentary than just a $100,000 documentary. So we're pretty happy with the production value and kind of what the team was able to put together, you know. And like I said before, Michael DeGrazier, my co-director and editor, he did a phenomenal job.
All right. We're talking with Ben Politis. When we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions about Missing 411, the movie, or whatever else you got on your mind. Stick with us. Patsy Cline takes us into the break. From 1964, that's The Beatles, I'll Be Back. We're talking with Ben Politis, the co-director of the Missing 411 movie. He is ready to take your questions and comments both about the movie and about the work he's done with his father. So far, we haven't got him to spill any family secrets, but we'll keep trying. The phones are pretty full, and we'll get to as many of your calls and comments and questions as we can in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to our final segment this evening. Ben Politis is my guest. We go to the phones. First-time caller, Cameron in Downey, California. Hi, Cameron. Welcome to the program. Hello, Cameron.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I actually had a question for Dave, but since he's not on the air, I'll just ask you guys anyways. So I've been following you guys for quite a while since you've been doing the Missing 411, and there's plenty of trends that are pretty evident throughout all his books. But I'm just wondering, has there ever been any thought put into maybe testing some of the DNA and seeing if there's any similarities with genetics? That's something, I mean, if people are getting abducted or they're going missing, I don't want to draw any conclusions in respect to Dave, but perhaps that's something that's been overlooked. There might be a genetic similarities between the people who are missing and
interesting
maybe
point,
being abducted.
Ben, any discussion about genetic similarities or some kind of DNA link?
That's an interesting point he brings up. I don't know. I think it's interesting that there's a lot of crippled and handicapped children that still missing, and you know, one could argue that maybe that's due to their condition, but maybe they're being targeted because of their genetics. I'm not one to speculate either way, but I think it's an interesting theory and maybe a avenue that should be pursued.
Appreciate the idea, Cameron. That's an interesting thought. Maybe we'll find out what Dave has to say about that. West of the Rockies, Chris in Redding, California. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I'm a private security guard here at Whiskeytown National Park Service, and I'm standing out here, and I just wanted to let the folks know that, we have a campground here with 90-plus people. We constantly have issues here of physical violence, people stealing, people cutting up other people's camping gear. I am the only one out here, and the rangers, I had an incident where I had to call the rangers. There was an individual out here driving drunk with his child, trying to unload and load his boat, and the rangers would not show up. And what's interesting is when I call their dispatch, it goes all the way to the Sequoia National Park, or up here at Whiskeytown. It's hundreds of miles away. To make a long story short, these rangers kind of bullied me, and they didn't want me talking to the California Highway Patrol that finally showed up. And I thanked them. I said, these rangers will refuse to come out after 9 o'clock, and it's a two-hour wait. So, in other words, there's 90 people here. I have a flashlight. That's it. If anyone wanted to hurt these people, attack these people, kidnap these people, there's really nothing I can do, and no one's going to come out here for two solid hours. Another interesting thing I wanted to let you folks know is I was also at one time a firefighter engineer here at Whiskeytown National Park Service in the 90s, and one of the rangers showed me, there's two things that go on in this park. A lot of times people like to commit suicide here for some reason because they see it as such a beautiful spot. And he also showed me some caves, and it took back to these mines. And there's a devil worship of red and black candle wax, red and black writing all over the walls. There was a body found here, Kennedy Memorial Drive. One of the concessionaires had a dead cat struck to their trailer. There's a lot of crazy things that go on here. And Whiskeytown is running out of money. There's a fire. I'm standing right next to the fire station here. There's no one in this fire station. So if anyone come down screaming out of that camp, there's no one here to help them in fire.
Let me interrupt you for a second, Chris. I feel for the folks who work on public lands, National Park Service, BLM, the U.S. Forest Service. There's not enough money to go around, millions and millions of acres, and I can see that they're stretched pretty thin. I guess what I would ask you, the topic that we're on tonight about missing 411, have you encountered anything like that, heard stories like that in your neck of the woods?
Well, this is more of a preventative thing. This is a tragedy here at this campground is waiting to happen. They have these solar lights that come on at night. 95% of them don't work. It's pitch black here.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a no. I appreciate the input. We're just going to try to keep it on the subject of the missing folks. But thank you for calling and sharing with us the difficulties that you're facing there at that national park. We're going to go east of the Rockies, Preston in Daytona Beach. Hi, Preston.
Hey, George. It's good talking to you again. Thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind?
I always like to put in a military spin on things because, I'm in the military, and I was actually hoping to talk to David, but I'd be glad to talk to Ben, too. And, it's funny, you talk about these national parks, so many of them are covered by military airspace for training purposes only. What's to say that they're not doing training out there where no one's looking, with some of these things like this pixelation thing that we were talking about earlier? you know, holograms. I mean, we've already got those with kid Cracker Jack toys. You know, do you guys feel like maybe that's a perfect place to test out new equipment instead of where everyone's watching on a military base?
Ben, I can't remember if you touch on the possibility that it's a human activity or not in the film, but have you ever talked about that with your dad?
Well, like in the film, we looked at all the parents and people who were involved, but, you know, obviously that's a far cry from military. I haven't really talked to him much. I mean, I think in some of the instances there could be some sort of military intervention if you're way out there in the middle of nowhere, but I personally never heard anything.
And Preston, I would point out that these cases, the disappearances, have been going on for at least a century. For a lot longer than we would have had the technology to do something like that. But as we learned in the show about the book Camellio, there are a lot of folks working on that. So I think it can't be tossed out entirely. Thanks for the call. We're going to go to the wild card line. Mary in Phoenix. Hi, Mary.
Thank you for taking my call. Ben, really excited about the film. Yep. I wondered if you or your father had any kind of theory about this predator or whatever, why it seems to target the bow hunters. And maybe it has something to do with the sound frequency or electromagnetic something that, gun hunters don't get targeted as much or something because it attracts more attention or because it disperses the sound that maybe they work along those waves or I don't know what. But I was just curious, you know, why bow hunters seem to be more, victims. And if there was any theories you guys had about that.
I mean, yeah, those are all interesting theories. I'm personally unfamiliar with any of that, but maybe, you know, I could see maybe something like that happening, some sort of frequency or noise or but my dad would have been the good one to ask that for sure.
So you've been working on the film as he's been working on the book about hunters.
Right. I know I've only talked to him in passing, actually, about his latest book because we've been working so hard on this documentary trying to get it out there. But I know that from what I've read, the excerpts he sent me, it's, you know, I think it might be some of his most important work just in terms of kind of what's systematically happening out there.
Yeah, Mary, I would just have to guess that his answer would be, you know, we really don't know. Don't know why anyone is targeted for sure. But it is weird that the percentage of bow hunters is higher than the percentage of hunters who are carrying firearms. Thanks for the call. We're going to go to Keith in Wisconsin. Hi, Keith.
As far as bow hunters, part of the reason why they might get targeted is in most states, the bow season is a lot longer. These guys are more religious about getting to their bow stands.
Oh.
Also, too, you got that guy you were talking about in the Crazy Mountains, or your dad was talking about in the Crazy Mountains, where they found his boots and they found his gear, found his bow and such. He probably had a second pair of shoes, and he was probably going into lost delirium, and he was yard sailing his gear because he thought it was weighing him down. But as far as this goes, Have you ever thought about the angle of possibility of Sasquatch kidnappings? I heard of a couple cases up in Saskatchewan where guys had gone out on their canoes and had gotten grabbed. And these were guys. These were, you know, guys going out hunting. And they'd be gone for, you know, 2 or 3 days. And they would find themselves getting grabbed up in the middle of the night by Sasquatches.
Ben, in the course of putting the film together, did you have anybody raise the idea that maybe Bigfoot is doing abductions or is responsible for some of these people disappearing?
If we heard anything, it was only secondhand. None of the people we interviewed said that to us. I've heard of stories, I think, of eyewitness accounts maybe, of things like that happening, but I've never heard from anybody firsthand about that. No,
I know a lot of people have emailed the program here, Coast to Coast, with that suggestion, in part because your father, when he first appeared on the show, it was to talk about Bigfoot, the first two books that he wrote about Sasquatch research and Native Americans and I think people were trying to put two and two together, suggesting that he secretly suspected that Bigfoot was behind it. I think he would probably say he does not believe that to be the case, but is maintaining an open mind. We're going to try Harry in Austin, Texas. Hi, Harry.
Hi, George.
Good morning.
I got a question. It was for David, but maybe Ben would know. If y'all have ever sought the help of psychic detectives who help many law enforcement agencies around the United States find missing people, both dead and alive, and sometimes they'll find them up to 20 years after they were, you know, were buried out in the middle of nowhere.
Ben, did you ever think about talking to psychics about helping with the searches, and or have any of the law enforcement folks who you interviewed or talked to for the film, have they resorted to that?
So that, yeah, I think he broke up there a little bit, but I think I got the gist of it. So I haven't heard of any of that psychics, and I wish, you know, you could have asked my dad about that, because I'm certain he would have an answer for you. But all I can say is that that's an interesting angle for sure.
We'll try east of the Rockies, Tom in the Bronx. Good morning, Tom.
Warriors. I like to say this. When there were people jumping off the trade centers because of the fires and explosions, a lot of these individuals never made it to the ground. They actually disintegrated in the air. The same held true for the bathrooms that were falling down to the ground. They turned into literal dust. I wonder if there are government projects, sinister government projects that are actually, in some cases, actually disintegrating some people, maybe using some kind of very sadistic equipment, maybe for war use eventually or whatever. I mean, I know it sounds paranoid for me to say that.
No, I think it's something that maybe should be looked at. It's interesting. Beyond that, you know, I don't know. It sounds like it's something of science fiction, but a lot of this stuff kind of does.
Yeah, so, and again, you know, a lot of these disappearances happened a long time ago, 80, 90, 100 years ago. So there was certainly not that kind of technology back when those happened. It might explain some kind of cases now, although I'd wonder how you make the body disappear and leave the clothing and the boots. Interesting idea, Tom. Thank you. We're going to try Lily in northern Minnesota on the wild card line. Hi, Lily.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of points. The map that Mr. Pleiades shows on the clusters in the United States, when I saw that, it really struck me that there's a whole section right down the middle, and particularly in the Dakotas, where it doesn't look like there are any markings. And I just was wondering if anybody's been looking into the areas that nothing is happening that might give a clue as to, you know, why those areas are different, might point you in the direction of looking at, you know, why it's happening in other places. And the second point is, with the guys bringing up Bigfoot, I've been listening to Dogman stories and Bigfoot stories on YouTube from a couple of different channels, and almost all of them say the same thing, that when right before they had some kind of encounter, particularly with Dogman, is everything went silent in the woods. You know, from insects to birds to any other animals. And you mentioned that that happened with the lady that was bull hunting. And I think that might be a major clue in this. And thank you for what you guys are doing and looking into this. And just also wanted to say how much I appreciate George Knapp and the bumper music and his great way of interviewing. Thank you.
Thanks, Lily. I guess it would be tough, kind of a challenge for your team, Ben, your father and you, to look into areas where stuff is not happening, since you have a, you know, you're stretched pretty thin looking at the areas where it is happening. But that's an interesting right. idea, why it happens in some places and not others. I don't think you have an answer.
No, I think, yeah, the clusters are somewhat of a mystery outside of, I mean, the national park ones. But, yeah, thanks a lot for the support, Lily.
The idea about the dog man, that's pretty interesting. We've had a couple of shows about that. I had not heard that there is a similar phenomena where the woods get quiet when these things appear. But, you know, we don't know what the answer to this thing is. So it might have many faces. You know, it might look like a chameleon, kind of a predator to some people and a dog man to another. Nobody has an answer for it. Try to get one more quick call in. West of the Rockies, Kevin. Better make it a quick call, Kevin.
Yeah, I work in search and rescue. I have an air scent dog and a cadaver dog both. And I've been on many searches, and there's usually, you know, good reasons why these people disappear. Every once in a while, you just have no clues. But the thing I was curious about in the production of your film is, are you using any of the training techniques that the... we use to train these dogs?
We actually aren't out there searching. We're just interviewing the families and law enforcement and officials to understand what happened to these kids or what could have happened. Because we're interviewing people across multiple decades. We're not actively out there searching. But we did interview two ladies in search and rescue with their dogs. And they talked about one of the searches they were on and the techniques they used to find these children. So to your point, yeah, we try to get all perspectives, including search and rescue and everything they do.
And in general, Ben, is there a level of cooperation with search and rescue folks, or do they look at you as sort of interlopers who don't understand what they do?
Yeah, I mean, everybody we interviewed who was involved in search and rescue, from you know, a former sheriff of Klamath County to these two, you know, ladies who their whole job is to go out there and search for missing people. Everybody was really cooperative because they all had experience with these kind of strange phenomena. So, you know, and strange things do happen in the wilderness. It's kind of an untapped mysterium of things in there. So, yeah, I mean, from my experience, to answer your question, yes.
So if the film will come out, the public can see it beginning of the year, somewhere around there, and you're entering it in festivals. If it goes as well as you hope it goes, is there another one in the works, or you think it could become a series of films as well as books?
I would like to see it become a series. Hopefully, you know, after we sell it, somebody, you know, it does well, and we can, you know, make it into a broader, you know, kind of a series maybe or something of the sort, because the public needs to know what's going on. So, yeah, I would love to see it get to that point.
There's certainly a lot of material to work with. It could be a series on TV that could go on for a long time. Ben Politis, thanks very much. Look forward to having you back after the film is out and the public can get a look at it. Thanks. Thanks also to Dave Politis, of course. The Missing 411 Hunters Unexplained Disappearances is the new book. We have links on our website. And I want to say thanks to my colleagues there who helped put on tonight's program, Jeff DeRay, Donna Walker, Dan Galanti, our webmaster Lex, and producer Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. Good night, everyone.